Well, my wife asked me when I came home from my first flight to Mars, and she says, well, what's it like? And I says, big, really big. Where I flew for 30 years, I didn't fit, you know, up the inlets and cutting through the passes here and there, rat racing around in a Beaver. It's a whole new dynamic on decision-making, everything you do. It's totally different.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 42 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats, along with the people within our industry. If you're new to the show, we've had pilots from all over the world. Engineers, float manufacturers, firebombing pilots, instructors, and even those who don't fly, sharing their knowledge and stories involved with seaplanes for us all. To get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. Or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at That Mallard Guy. Thanks to Daniel Marley, a PPL holder in Sydney, who sent me an email about a very interesting article about an airline pilot sharing his humbling experience regarding a wheels down water landing. I'll share that all for you via Instagram for you to have a read. Great to see there are a lot of you who are jumping on Apple Podcasts to review the show as well. Last week, we had another two great reviews come in, and that takes us to 65 star written reviews for On The Step. Only 40 to go for our goal of 100. For those of you who have helped this show grow bigger and bigger by reviewing via Apple Podcasts, I say thanks to you for your efforts. This week's new patron is Al Hymers. After releasing Al's episode last week all about his career flying the CL415 water scoopers, Al has come on board as a Patreon subscriber and joined as a Super Cub float plane tier member. Thanks very much, Al, for your support. Now don't forget, folks, On The Step is proudly sponsored by the Seaplane Pilots Association. This week I received my bi-monthly colour Seaplane magazine in the mail all the way from the USA to my doorstep in Darwin, Australia here. It's the only Seaplane magazine available worldwide, and it's available only for SPA members. Now, membership is normally $59 a year. However, the Seaplane Pilots Association has teamed up with me at On The Step, and they are giving fans of the show memberships via the link in the show notes for only $49. Not only do you get their incredible Seaplane magazine six times a year, but you are giving back to the industry you love most. So go and check it out and join today. Alrighty, folks, on to today's episode. Today's guest has been recommended to me by at least 10 people. I think he was actually getting sick of people telling him to come on the show. When us seaplane mad pilots and enthusiasts think about a flying boat we would all love to get our hands on, we will all agree that the Martin Mars would be a dream come true. Well, Peter Killen has lived out that dream, flying this enormous World War II era boat for over 17 years as a water scooping and firebombing captain. I must admit, even with the pressure from his peers, trying to get Pete on the phone was no easy task. And seeing photos of this moustached man, I was a little bit nervous myself. But let me tell you, Pete is one of the most kind-hearted gentlemen I've ever spoken to. This interview was a real pleasure. Make sure you listen until the end as Pete shares a recent scare that nearly took his life. It's a great lesson to us all that no matter how experienced you are, you can still be bitten in our game. Let's all take the tender out to our ship. Throwing our gear inside the rear door, we'll climb aboard and take the stairs to the upper deck. Turning over and starting all four engines, we'll give our Mars a good warm-up, go through our checks, and start our takeoff run. Sliding along on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, welcome to On The Step, an episode I am absolutely hanging out to get recorded. Mr. Peter Killen, how are you going, Pete?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And you?
Very, very good, mate. It's 5 a.m. here in Australia, and I'm talking to you. It's about lunchtime over there in Canada. I've been up since about 4:15. I didn't even wake up to my alarm, mate, because I'm just been so excited to get you on the phone and talk all about the incredible Martin Mars. Is it everything that everyone wishes it to be and more?
I think so. You know, thinking back to the people I've met, you know, along the way, I've never met a 747 pilot or anybody from the airlines that really didn't want to have, you know, their hand on a crack at flying the Mars. It's such a cool airplane.
Yeah, and it's exceptional that, you know, you mentioned to me yesterday when we spoke that you've got over, or just on 1,000 hours in this thing. Now, a lot of people would probably say that, oh, 1,000 hours, that's not much. But when you're talking about an aircraft this old and used so specifically in water bombing, it's almost like a very specific fighter pilot kind of hour building, you know, example, isn't it?
I never really thought about it as a fighter pilot. What we did, or how the airplane was utilized, it was a fire truck. It was made ready over the winter. A ton of maintenance was done. The airplane was taken or put back in the water and put on the buoy, ready to go. And, you know, if we had a dry summer, we would get, I think one summer we got 300 hours or a little bit over 300 hours. And by the time we got to that, there was only two pilots and it's a two crew airplane. So there's just Deb and myself, who unfortunately passed away just a couple months ago in March from cancer, which was a real real bummer for us. He was our chief pilot. And basically now we're down to just myself and whoever we can scramble to get in the airplane. And I think it's kind of the end of the road for the aircraft. There might be a delivery flight or two because we have both aircraft still sitting at Sprout Lake. But getting back to the utilization, one summer was an extremely wet summer and the airplane only flew 7 hours.
Wow.
So, and that was 7 hours between four captains. So the only other, that was like combat flying, I call it. We have our weekly currency flights that we do when we're on contract, but very little flying. So I think my seasons, and I was there almost 17 years, I think the low hours was like 56 revenue hours, up to about 80, and then 120, and then towards the end, when there was just Dev and myself, it was down to, let me think here. Well, we did that 327, something like that. I don't know the exact numbers, and there was a 200-hour season. So we had some pretty awesome revenue flying there. Where we really started to shine was when Colson's bought the airplane and tricked us out with the latest and greatest aircraft, nice synthetic vision. It sure made our jobs a lot easier and a lot safer. When I got there was a Garmin 150 in the aircraft for our precision flying.
Yeah, well... yeah, that's incredible, Pete. And I'm really sorry to hear about the passing of Devin. That's terrible news.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Mate, well, before we jump too much into this aircraft, I'd love to hear a little bit about your history as well. So can you take us back and tell us about how you got into flying seaplanes back in the day?
Okay. Yeah, where I grew up, central coast of British Columbia, it's about 320 miles north of Vancouver. Basically, I say halfway between Vancouver and the Alaska Panhandle. Mid-coast, growing up, Grummins were king. You probably fly some of our airplanes that we had coming into Ocean Falls. BC Airlines was the sked machine out of Vancouver. And actually, I think it was even Pacific Western at one point. And then we had the Goose coming in from Prince Rupert, you know, three times a week. So basically, I grew up where Grumman's were in their heyday. Wigeon's charter machines would come up from Vancouver. Fuller Paints would come in with their private Mallard out of Southern California. Some pretty cool stuff went on for me, you know, being a little kid. And there was no roads. The only way to our town was by coastal freighter or aircraft. So I grew up with that. And all I wanted to do was fly from day one. I got to see the Mars when I was 8 years old. And boy, I never dreamt I would become a Mars captain, but here I am.
Exactly, yeah. And what was the Mars like back then when you saw it at 8 years old?
It had just come up from California, and I did a speaking engagement with Dan McIver, who was the man that brought the Mars into the firefighting world. And I told him the time and the date, and he put a time stamp on it. And Caroline Mars was being converted, and they brought Philippine Mars up to Sprout Lake and were doing it for crew training before it was even a water bomber. You know, so the guys got current on the aircraft and how it flew before it became a water bomber. And so he actually put a timestamp on it and an aircraft, and it was still painted. Whitewash painted, faded blue U.S. Navy markings. So it was kind of neat to, you know, planted the seed then. I kind of wish my dad had stayed alive long enough to see me become a Mars pilot. My mom did, but my dad didn't.
Yeah, wow. Did your dad have any aviation influence?
He hated airplanes. He hated airplanes. He was a sailor.
Oh, then he wouldn't have minded you getting a flying boat then.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah. he saw my career go, and I was, he died in 92, and I was flying Beech 18s on floats and stuff here in Campbell River where I live. I did that for 14 years.
Yeah, wow. And what was the Beech 18 like to fly on floats?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it was a fun airplane. I ended up, I think I was about 3,500 hours on floats in that airplane and probably 35 hours on wheels. Not very much. We had a tri-gear Beech 18 on wheels. I flew a bit.
Yeah, wow. And what other, you know, smaller jobs, I'd say, you know, getting into the industry as you kind of built your time, did you do as a float plane pilot?
So how my career went, I only had a private license because I was colorblind. And I fought tooth and nail because all I wanted was day VFR. I just wanted to fly.
Yeah.
So I ended up in Kelowna working at the airport as a mechanic. And I still, all I wanted to do was fly, but that was probably the best thing I ever did was get my engineer's license first, because when I sent my resumes out for becoming an employed pilot, it usually got looked at. I think I sent out 60 resumes and I got 20 jobs sight unseen all across Canada. So it was a good move, and I only got one call from BC. And it was out in Tofino, which is very rugged flying, but it sure taught me how to fly, you know, especially in high winds and reduced visibility conditions. So it was good. It taught me how to fly. And I did a couple years out there. Then I ended up with Harbor Air in Vancouver. I did 4 years there and flew Cessnas, beavers, otters, twin otters. And then I hated the city. I'm not a city guy. So I ended up getting a job offer to come to Campbell River. And we were a very small airline, 180, 185, and two beavers. And I flew that for 14 years. And in that time, he upgraded to one Beech 18, then two, then three, then four, then five.
Wow.
So we had a lot. I ended up doing a lot of beach flying just because we grew exponentially there. And that kind of works me over to the Mars side of things. The guy that Al Riley was a Transport Canada guy. I think he's long retired now. Used to do our check rides. And after a check ride, I was walking up the dock with him and I says, Al, I said, yeah, and I knew he did the check rides on the Mars. I says, do I have the right qualifications to become a Mars captain? And he thought about it for a second. He says, yes, you do. So I kind of put a chuckle on my smile on my face. And when I got home that night, I put pen to paper and I sent away a resume to Flying Tankers. And I got a letter back stating that they're putting my paperwork on file. I appear to meet the qualifications that they have. And they had pretty high numbers for qualifications. What they wanted was, I think it was either 5 or 7,000 hours total time, 3,000 hours multi-flying boat time, and coastal flying boat time. And also, they wanted you to have an engineer's license. And I had all those qualifications, except I didn't have any flying boat time. Mine was twin engine float plane, but they were okay with that. He says, well, nobody flies to Mars. You know, it's specific training, everything. So the next year, the general manager had hired a friend of mine who flies at Harbor Air now. He said, is Killen still looking to come to work here? And he says, yep. And they offered me a bird dog flying, which is fire patrols and leading the Mars into the smoke. And the 185 was on wheels, so it was a little firecracker. It was a lot of fun. You know, I could go rat racing and just giving her. And I loved it. So I did that for the first year. And believe it or not, at the end of that season, and I flew fire patrols all over the province and wherever the airplane got detached or deployed on fires, I would go and then I'd do the assessment runs for the aircraft. And at the end of the season, they put me in the Mars.
Wow.
And started the training. And it's huge expense, like unbelievable. I had to have 10 hours and they put me in the left seat. So that was kind of cool. And, you know, you're burning 700 gallons an hour.
Wow.
When we're hauling water, you know, a load, we're up over 800 gallons an hour. So it's huge, huge expense. I think it was like $25,000 an hour for gas.
Jesus.
No, it's not quite that much, but it's a lot. And so they banged off 10 hours and then set up a check, you know, a monitored ride with Transport Canada. Well, they didn't have anybody that did it, so the former chief pilot from Tankers who had taken a buyout, they brought him in to do my check ride. And he says, okay, Peter, we'll just go do a simple right seat ride and get your paperwork done. And I said, Hugh, I says, I've never been in the right seat. I said, okay, well, we'll do a left seat ride then. Bang. I got my endorsement on the aircraft. And then the next year I did a little bit, but you don't become a firebombing captain at 10 hours.
No.
You have to have something like 50 hours on fires and, you know, you build up to it, and it takes 3-4 years. So I'm a patient guy. I'm living the dream. I'm not going anywhere. So I just stuck with it. And I left the company for a little while. I had a little set to a disagreement, not a disagreement. I didn't have an agreement with this guy. So I just says, well, you're not firing me. I'm out of here. And they kept kind of tabs on me where I was, what I was doing. And then when Colson's bought the airplane, the problem child I had was no longer with the company. And I had a 2-year time out. I left in June of 2005 and I was back in April of 2007. So not quite 2 years away from it.
Yeah.
But I really missed it when I was gone. And the rest was history. It turned into a damn good job. And I'm still there waiting for whatever happens with the delivery.
Yeah, wow.
You know, it'll go somewhere, I'm hoping. But it doesn't like sitting for extended periods of time.
No, I bet.
That aircraft.
Exactly.
But it's all, you know, they have furnaces on the deck outside the aircraft and plumbed in. So all the aircraft is something like $20,000 worth of home heating fuel goes into keeping the inside of the aircraft temperature controlled, because it's an electrical nightmare. It's got 7.5 miles of wiring in there.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Can you tell us a little bit, Pete, about why the aircraft was introduced back in, you know, before the war, and or just kind of during the war, actually, and a little bit of the history of the aircraft?
From what I know, the design, I think, is 1938, and the first aircraft was called the Old Lady, XPB-2M Mars, and it was a double tail, like a Beech 18, canted in a little bit, but it was a twin-tailed four-engine flying boat, and it had 2,200 horsepower engines and three-bladed props, and they had some issues with it, and they ended up upgrading to 3350-24s with a four-bladed prop. And that made it a much nicer aircraft. They were initially called a JRM-1, and through various upgrades, they were all upgraded to a JRM-3 classification. The all-up weight is 162,000 pounds, and our OEW, operational empty weight, when we're sitting on the buoy ready to go to work, it's about we would have 3,500 gallons of gas in it. And that would give us 4 hours on the fire, basically within an hour's radius of Port Alberni.
Yeah, wow. It's such a big airplane. I mean, I wrote down some stats before. I want to talk about the wingspan for a second here. I've just written down some different wingspans on different aircraft and different flying boats. So here we go. So the Albatross, for example, Grumman Albatross, pretty big flying boat, 29.5 meters or 96 feet for the wingspan.
Yeah.
The Catalina, 32 meters and 104 feet. So we're getting a little bit bigger. The Shinmewa US-2, 33 meters, 109 feet. And then we got the Sunderland flying boat, 35 meters, 114 feet. Now, the next one I could find that was... still underneath the Mars, Boeing 747-300, 60 meters, 196 feet. The Martin Mars, 61 meters, 200-foot wingspan. That is incredible.
Yeah, the only thing bigger is Howard Hughes.
Yep, and I wrote Spruce his Steve. Down. Yep, it's a ridiculous.
What's that, 365?
No, 320 feet, 98 meters. Unfortunately, Howard Hughes was not available for an interview.
No. I sat in the seat.
Did you? Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I'd love to check that aircraft out at the museum for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
But, mate, yeah, the size of this thing is just unfathomable, you know, like, it must have been incredible, like you said, going from that Cessna 185 on wheels, just ripping that around the air, to jumping into this enormous boat.
Well, my wife asked me when I came home from my first flight in the Mars, and she says, well, what's it like? And I says, big, really big. Where I flew for 30 years, I didn't fit, you know, up the inlets and cutting through the passes here and there, rat racing around in a Beaver. It's a whole new dynamic on decision-making, everything you do. It's totally different.
Yeah, I can only imagine, like you said, they're kind of where you would take normal seaplanes, that what we would call normal, you know, your Beavers, 185s, that kind of stuff. You'd have no chance of getting this aeroplane even near them. And you'd have to calculate, I imagine, a lot of your routes in and out of valleys and around mountains, especially when firebombing, because of the size of this aeroplane.
Exactly. You know, you always have to have an out pretty big, you know. But, you know, after a while, like I say, I spent almost 17 years around the airplane. And towards the end, you just hop in the airplane and you go flying.
Yeah.
And I got pretty comfortable in it, you know. But it wasn't, you know, lackadaisical comfortable. It was treat it with respect and it'll take care of you kind of comfortable. I got to fly with some pretty haywire guys. And I was glad I came from a float plane background and not an airline background, because it didn't work in my mind. In some ways it did, but boy, you sure got to be careful. It's a day VFR airplane. There's no boots. There's no anti-ice. And it's just, you got to treat it with respect and you got to stay out of IMC with it. And having said that, now, there's no IMC when you're going in on a fire and it's smoky beyond belief and rough and turbulent and full deflections. I mean, it gets pretty exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. Can we just touch back a little bit again about with the history a little bit? It broke a few records back in the day, didn't it, with some passenger carrying numbers?
Yeah, what's a couple short, well, it did a short flight from Alameda down to San Diego. And I don't know the exact numbers, but like 312 or 317 field dress troop. You know, I'm not sure the exact number, but it was huge. And another record-breaking flight was Honolulu nonstop to Chicago.
Well, to Chicago.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And not so much a record, but a miracle. It lost three engines on a Trans-Pacific flight, and it made it back to Alameda basically in ground effect.
Wow.
On one.
Which one was left?
I'm not sure. I would hope it was an inboard.
Yeah, now there's some like that troop carrying one is insane. Like just on 300 people in the back of this airplane.
Oh, I know.
Once again, the size of this thing is incredible. There's some incredible photos actually taken by some photographers, you know, around the world of this at Oshkosh and everything. And when you see it on a mooring and with people out the nose there, it really kind of puts it into perspective a little bit more. But yeah, it's really hard for someone who hasn't seen the aircraft just to try and to visualize this.
Well, that was a wonderful trip for us. And I was part of the crew. was 9.4 hours from Sprout Lake to Lake Winnebago at Oshkosh.
Yeah, wow.
And when we got there, we could have kept going for another 4 hours.
Yeah, wow.
Because we dipped the tanks and, you know, economy fuel burn is about, he can, Roy, who's our flight engineer, or Dave, they can get it tweaked back to under 350 gallons an hour. And we left with 5260, I think it was, fuel on board.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, the dipstick, mate, that must be almost a tree trunk, is it? Just
no, actually, we had a guy who was a transplant. He left Transport Canada and came to work, and he didn't understand this type of aircraft at all. And there was a letter on file, like he made a complaint back to Transport that we were using a broomstick for a dipstick.
Yeah.
Well, we were, but we had a letter of approval authorizing the use of a calibrated broomstick. And we kind of chuckled, and it as much as he tried to get it upgraded to something, and I don't know what, and you know, you put 100 gallons in, you dip the stick into it, you mark it, then you cut a circle around this, and it was a broom handle. Then you add 100 gallons and 100 gallons and 100 gallons until you get to the top of the tank. The rear tanks were, so we had two calibrated broomsticks for the front tanks, because the way Hawaii Mars is, the two center tanks and a portion of number one and two tanks and a portion of number five and six tanks were used for the belly dropping bomb system. Just to give you an idea how big those fuel tanks are, when I'm standing on the floor and I'll do a dip, it's 8 feet down to the bottom of the keel, and it's 13 feet wide.
Wow.
And another interesting note is the fuel system. Very complicated. Flight engineers say, oh, it's nothing. But you know float planes, you know floats, they all leak. All our fuel is kept below the waterline.
Oh, wow.
So every gallon of that 5,000 gallons is below sea level,
yeah,
or below the water level. So it's always considered contaminated. So through a series of piping, and it comes up two floors to the upper flight deck, and it goes through, it looks like a lava lamp. It's about a 3 gallon sight gauge, and the fuel's pumped through it, and the dirty fuel, like it's dirty fuel, and there's soap, and there's just water, there's all kinds of junk in it, and it goes through this sight gauge, and then there's a spigot that you can open a tap to drain that contamination out of the system, and then it goes up another deck, the third floor, basically to wing tanks, which are two 500 gallon tanks behind two and three. And those are the service tanks that feed like number one and two and number three and four. So by the time the fuel's gone up from the belly tank through the water separators, water filters, and into the wing, so it's basically like a Super Cub with a header tank, only my header tank is 500 gallons. And that then feeds to the engines. You can cross feed, and we all know how cross feeds work, supply side, non-supply side. You can actually have a selection hull to engines. We don't use that selection for safety purposes. because you could put contaminated fuel in.
Yeah.
You know, to sit at the bottom of the tank and have an inch of water is not uncommon, you know, a leaking rivet or what have you. But an inch of water is probably 50 gallons of water. So you know, fuel contamination is an issue.
Yeah.
We tore the belly out of the airplane, hit a log, and lost the two front tanks. Luckily, with 500 gallons in the wings, that's an hour, just over an hour's flying. So we got to get home. We just off the fire, gone.
Yeah, what about refueling? Is that a bit of a challenge for such a big size aircraft?
Understatement. So at Sprout Lake, we have a couple 20,000 gallon tanks, great big fuel tanks up on the shore. And they're pumped down through filters and out underwater to a fuel buoy, we call it. And that's a single point nozzle that is embedded in a great big tractor tire, you know, and it's inflated so it floats, and it's anchored to the floor, and it's on flex lines, so it changes with the amount of water in the lake or the lake levels. So that's pretty simple. And then there's a little hull of it's a converted tugboat, and it has a series of filters on it. So the fuel's filtered at the fuel farm. It's filtered at the fuel buoy. Then it goes into the aircraft, and then it's filtered again by the time it gets upstairs to the engines. That's how it's done at the base. When we go remote, we have a specific semi-trailer fuel tanker and a B-train, kind of like it carries a lot of fuel. If we bring in the fuel tanker and the B-train, that's good for a day and a half if we're working. It doesn't last very long.
No, it must be such a mission to get, you know, fuel to these remote locations, and especially when you don't know where you're going, depending on where the fire is.
You know, it's dangerous goods, and you don't just call up the fuel vendor and say, you know, I need 9,000 gallons of gas brought out to the lake. And that's basically what it does. But we'll take our fuel tanker, go to the refinery, wherever, you know, they buy their fuel. Then they go out to the lake. And then we carry in the Mars 500 feet of 3-inch fuel hose, and it's wrapped with the swimming pool, the kids' pool noodles, you know, and we duct tape them every 10 feet to this black hose as it pulls out 500 feet. Like that's how much we have, and it's all that fluorescent green and fluorescent pink. And it's perfect because it makes the fuel line float, because we've had boats come through there and almost hit them. And it's a real problem when it's black. But when they see the pool noodles, then they usually pull away. But marine traffic's a real problem, especially when you get it to, you know, holiday spots. You know, everybody, it's a magnet for jet skis.
Yeah, and kayakers, I imagine. And
yeah, oh, just unbelievable.
Steve Stackhouse told us that there's a siren that goes off at Sprout Lake there when the Mars is going to be launched.
Like an air raid.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty cool. Everybody heads out on their boats to watch the Mars taxi out.
It's the opposite to an air raid siren, isn't it? Because everyone then heads out to the airplane rather than running away from it.
Yeah, well, how we, you know, when we're in fire season, we're on alert. And depending on what our alert status is we have to be within 30 minutes of the aircraft. Or on red alert, we have to be ready for immediate. So what we do is we go out, depending on our status, but most times we'll go out and warm the aircraft up and be ready to go, because each oil tank is 90 gallons. I think the capacity is like 110 gallons, but top X on the dipstick is 90 gallons. So it takes 45 minutes to get all the oil up to temp.
Wow.
So if we got to do an immediate departure, we're 45 minutes. So we go out in the morning and do a warm up and a short flight back for a little bit of currency, because it's a really busy airplane. And then we land, pull up to the buoy. Now we're ready to go. We can hop in the airplane because that oil heat sinks, and it takes a long time for 100 gallons of oil to come out of 40C. You know, like it stays warm.
Yeah.
So we can get going right away.
And what's it like? You mentioned there before, but you know, having the flight engineers in the back there. But what's it like actually flying this airplane up the front, and how do you all work together as a crew to kind of achieve the goal?
Well, it's a challenge response checklist. The engineers have another checklist that doesn't involve the pilots, but when we're, you know, doing our pre-start checklist, it's too bad I should have had that checklist out so I could read it to you. It's pretty interesting. There's a prop master motor that you set for 2700 RPM, and then you do some checks. You're checking to make sure it's governing.
Yeah.
And it's four propellers you're doing. Our run-ups are done two engines at a time, so you got a balanced thrust. We'll get a call after he's got temp. He'll call temps and pressures normal. I'll take one and four for run-up. And I'll say, Roger, you have one and four, I have two and three, because you can only steer the aircraft on differential thrust.
Yeah.
So as he brings the power up, you can't do one and two on one side. You'd be just running in circles.
Yeah.
So I'll have two and three, and then I got to steer with two and three, which is harder because they're closer to the center line. So you need more power to make those, to keep it on track. There's no water rudders.
Yeah. And then what about actually in the air? Like, you know, let's say you take off at Sprout Lake there. Are you the one setting the power, or is the engineer taking over for that once you've set it? What about when you're airborne?
Okay, when I call for takeoff power, I'll just say, he'll say, temps and pressures are normal, run-up is complete, you have control. And okay, and then I say, okay, could we have a pre-takeoff checklist? And we go through a couple things like harnesses and hatches, doors, all the stuff that needs to be done before you take off. And then I have the power, I bring the power up. Max power is 54 inches of manifold pressure. So as it's coming up, then I'll say, engineer, you have the power. So I'm just driving. And then as I come out of the water, about 95, comes out a little bit less, but you just kind of fly and ground effect, get your airspeed, and then just start your levitation, because it doesn't do anything real fast. And then I'll call for either climb power, meto power, max power, cruise power. Meto is 47 and a half. Climb is 44, I think it is. I haven't been in the airplane for 4 years now.
Oh, wow. So
getting a little rusty.
Yeah. And then what about on the fires, mate? You know, how do you manage going in and dropping and flying the airplane at the same time?
Well, we used to take the power away from the engineers my first 5 years there, but then we developed a new way of doing things. And we gave the power to the engineers and asked him to maintain an airspeed. So whether we were, and we would call like, okay, we're pitching over, we're starting down, maintain 120 knots. And because we're airspeed limited, the doors can't come open, the bomb doors over 120. So we wouldn't let a load go if we were at 135 or something like that. It'll start doing damage, structural damage to the door mechanisms, especially on Philippine, because it only had four doors, side dropping doors. And they're great big wings. You know, they weigh like 300 pounds or so. They're cast aluminum.
And then, you know, after the dropping, you'd then take over the power again, would you? Or get him to set a climb power or something?
No, they automatically go to climb power after the drop.
Okay.
But then, you know, if you're coming over a ridge and you're starting down, you could just ask for min power after the drop. If you're just coming off the fire and starting down the hill, because, you know, we can be fairly high on different targets.
Yep.
Mexico, we had really, really high drops. Like, we were up at 5,400 feet, 5,700 feet, 5,900 feet. Our density altitudes were up over 9,000 feet.
Yeah.
So it created another set of issues.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then, you know, I've had some people on the show who have spoken about Firebosses and CL415s. And how they work, and what's the scooping process like for you when you go and scoop water?
Well, we'll come over the fence like a normal landing. We'll ask for a pre-drop check. The APUs are running, and we'll set flaps 40, you know, for full flap landing. Touchdowns, everything's predicated off the GPS for a hull speed. And we'll slow the airplane down to 65 knots, and I'll call engineer pilot, you have the power, probes are going down now, and that's his cue. When I put those probes down, that airplane pitches forward, and it's quite violent, and it's shuddering. And when he's gone to full power, the aircraft's trying to decelerate, because the probes are actually small, but a huge amount of weight is going into that aircraft. And most people don't have any idea of what's going on there, but it's putting on a ton a second into that airplane. So I can put 60,000 pounds into the airplane in 30 seconds.
Wow.
So you have to be careful with that, because if I'm out starting with an off the buoy weight of 120,000 pounds, I've only got 4,200 pounds of fuel or pounds of water, gallons, which is 40,000 pounds.
So you could potentially go overweight there if you scoop too much.
Oh, well, you do, because, we have sluice boxes, which are vents up. So if you've got a stuck probe, which happens, it just keeps the water coming.
Yeah.
And it just vents out overboard. So you can only put it in to 6,000 gallons, but it can be overweight, because you could only take 40,000, sorry.
And what kind of distances do you need on these lakes? You know, I can imagine that the Firebosses and the 415s are kind of scooping in some pretty tight areas, but the Mars must be pretty restricted to where it can actually scoop.
Yeah, absolute minimum for me. And some of the old guys that, you know, had been on the airplane for 30 years, went into some somewhat smaller lakes. But we always tried to have at least 4 miles of available lake, and hopefully clearways for approach and departure.
Yeah, that's a lot of room, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But it can be awful small, too. We were picking up Diamond Valley Reservoir, which was 4.5 miles long. And boy, we needed every inch of it. It's 115 degrees out. And I might add that 3350s don't like 115 degree temperatures.
Yeah, well, Steve was saying that, you know, it's incredible as well to think that, you know, these aircraft are operated on basically the worst days at low altitudes. So engine cooling must be a top priority, I could imagine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was the boys in the back job, and they're trying all different kinds of combinations to get air pushing through those cylinders. I hate to think what those temps are in the back cylinders. Yeah. I know what the oil temps are.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And to think those twin row radials, those rear cylinders just must be copying it.
You need the fuel flowing through it just to get some cooling from the fuel itself.
Speaking of those engines, mate, is you said they were 3,000 horsepower, were they?
2,500.
You know, how many of those are around these days? There mustn't be many around to kind of have a spare stock of engines if anything was to go wrong.
Well, we, you know, initially they had a whole pile of them that came with the initial purchase, but we go through a lot of engines.
Yeah.
And that's one of the main limiting factors now. And there's only like a 800-hour TBO on those engines. Well, I'll tell you, we didn't baby those engines.
Yeah, no.
But if we had a high-time engine, it was usually a good engine, you know. It's when they're brand new that, you know, they can be problematic.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the maintenance of the aircraft as well? Like, how many engineers would you need to have this thing, you know, keep this thing in the air? I mean, you mentioned that you're an engineer as well, so there's you're going to be probably doing a bit of work on it yourself, maybe. But an aircraft that size is going to require a lot of maintenance, wouldn't it?
Oh, tons. I think there was something like 30 employees in the heyday.
Yeah.
But in the end, I think we're down to like about 7 or 8. Could be a couple more. I could be forgetting a few, but they had a pretty good crew in the early days. Towards the end, well, like Coulson's, they've got a ton of, they can pull from the hangar up at the airport, the helicopter guys. A lot of those guys started with the company at the tanker base and then moved up to the airport on all the other stuff. It's pretty interesting place to be around nowadays.
Yeah.
With the 737s, the Hercs, bunch of Challenger jets, Citations, Sikorsky 61s, Sikorsky 76s, you name it, they have had it.
Yeah, what was it like when they first took over?
Oh, it was great. I got a job back. But it was pretty neat in that they took an old technology airplane and put it into the 21st century. Like we had the Garmin 600 synthetic vision and dual G600s or dual 450 Garmin. I mean, it's all dated stuff now, but 10 years ago, it was pretty nice stuff.
Yeah.
It sure made, you know, our transition to different places a lot easier when we could see the rocks out in the mountains. But, you know, you can't totally rely on it. But, boy, it sure put a lot of things at ease for us.
Yeah, a lot more situational awareness for sure.
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any interesting kind of stories about flying that as a water bomber there that you can recall?
Well, other than the, you know, Oshkosh and Mexico and northern Alberta, California, Oregon, like we saw a lot of territory. The human stories, like I've been in, you know, smoke and flames and, you know, so rough, blown engines, you know, just a million different things. We had the only field engine change that they ever did was up at Fraser Lake. That was quite the job, nosing the airplane onto a seaplane ramp that was designed for Cessnas and Beavers. And we had to put a ladder up to the nose, put the beaching gear on it to stabilize it, use a couple of cranes and tractors to tie the wings so they didn't flail around, and get another crane in to pick the engine. And first you got to pull the prop and then pull the engine and then hang the engine, then hang the prop. And that was pretty exciting.
How long did something like that take?
We were 26 hours.
Wow. That's pretty quick.
That was really quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a good one.
Especially for off-site, like, you know, engine change. That's fast.
Unbelievable. Then we taxied the airplane back on two engines, and then they finished up. They didn't want to be, you know, imposing on a little float plane operator. And they pulled them in, or pulled the aircraft off the beach, backed it up and motored down to our base that we had set up in Fraser Lake.
And I think the only thing that would annoy that little float plane operator is that all the pilots would be out there just looking at this thing all day long and not flying their planes.
Yeah, they helped us out immensely.
Yeah, right.
And most people are like that, you know. When we hit the bottom at Oshkosh, you know, the EAA gave us their shops up at the Oshkosh airport to build, you know, our patch that we had to put on.
What happened there?
We started, we did a pickup, and we were going to do a drop, a demo drop. And number four engine lost some power. The engineer called to abort, and we weren't high enough to pickle the load. So we just landed. And then we were taxiing back to the base. We didn't have an engine go. We just, it went from 54 inches to 40 inches of manifold, almost to station, you know, ambient pressure. We had a blower issue. So we taxied in, and we have a way of evacuating the water by you unwinch the back six doors, and that's behind the step. So the weight of the water opens those doors, and it just trails out, trail the doors, it's called.
Yeah.
And you get rid of all your water. But as we're taxiing in, we were at least a mile offshore, and we felt this little bump. Like it was very, it was nothing. Well, it was something. Very tip of the step, the keel drug bottom, and it kind of sliced a hole in the belly of the airplane. And it took out a chunk of the keel. So we had a baseball size chunk out of the step, which was very problematic to fix.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you first go and inspect that, and then how do you fix it?
Well, that was quite the effort on everybody's part. First off, the Coast Guard brought us some pumps, and then we had to get some more pumps, and it took three pumps running 24 hours a day just to hold the aircraft from completely filling. And then the airplane would have settled on the bottom at the float plane base at Oshkosh there.
Yeah.
And at 11 o'clock at night, in the pitch black with a flashlight, our company lawyer went under with some goggles on, and he had like 18 inches of maybe 2 feet between the hull of the airplane and the bottom of Lake Winnebago to feel around in there by braille, and found this hole. Then they had to figure out how big it was and what the repair was going to be. It was really tough. And I think it took like 4 days, 5 days for him to fix, plug it enough. And as it turned out, we tore the patch off when we got airborne. So we almost didn't get out of there. It was a huge, huge pull to get the airplane out of the water.
Yeah, that's pretty full on. I've actually been part of a kind of recovery on a Beaver float plane that had struck some reef and had put two holes on each side of each float, basically. And we required, you know, a fair bit of a mission there. It was over 24 hours before we could get airborne. And, you know, we had...
What did you do?
We had some dive gear. This is out at the Great Barrier Reef, so we had to fly out, you know, some dive gear, fly out a heap of tools, an air compressor. And basically, you had an engineer diving underneath and staying under the water there and basically just riveting on a patch.
The easiest way is to put a sheet of plywood across the bottom of the float on the inside and put inner tubes in there and fill the inner tubes with air.
Oh, yeah.
And it displaces the water.
Yeah.
And pushes it back out.
Yeah.
It's still heavy, but that's pretty common repair out this way.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, we had to just get this patch on so we could keep the water out, basically, so we could get the thing airborne. Because it doesn't take long and much of a full float to stop a beaver getting airborne, especially in the Whitsundays. It's pretty hot and amphib, and you know, and you've got a limited takeoff area as well. So it was a bit of an interesting one.
I'll bet.
It was similar to yours, really, but at least you had the 4 days there and probably a bit more people around you there to help out and get it done.
Yeah.
What other things about the Mars there, mate, that are very unique that you could share with us?
Oh, the people that you meet on the journey.
Yeah.
Everybody loves it. Everybody, you know, there's a lot of people that come to see the airplane, and there's a couple of interesting stories that I had happen to me. And one that the engineers had was they were down in Southern California. This was before my time. There was the Mars, Hawaii Mars was on the hook out in the lake. And this 94-year-old guy and his son came using his walker. He came up to our director of maintenance and says to him, "I used to own this airplane, Sonny." And it was Hugo Forrester. It was the guy that bought all four Mars from the U.S. Navy. He was a scrap metal dealer.
Oh, wow.
And he sold the four airplanes to Flying Tankers.
Yeah, right.
So that was kind of neat.
Yeah,
I had a retired Northwest Airlines captain, 757 captain, who was on his last legs with cancer. Him and his wife flew out from Minneapolis to Seattle, rented a car. They arranged a bed and breakfast at Sprout Lake and called the night before to see if the Mars was there, and it was, and So they started their journey out to Sprout Lake, and they got to the lake at midnight to their bed and breakfast. And in the morning, both Mars were gone. So he came over to the tanker base and asked where they were. And somebody said, well, they're up at a Soyuz. So him and his wife hopped in the car, drove to a Soyuz, which was, you know, it's a good day's drive. It's up in the Okanagan. And the next morning, I'm down having breakfast, and the guy saw my T-shirt or my hat or something, and he says, are you with the Mars? I says, yep. And I was flying the 185. That was my first year there. And he says, I have to see Philippine Mars. I have to see Philippine Mars. And I says, well, it's about 5 miles from here. You got to drive out the highway and take this road and that road. And I says, or I said, if you are ready to go, I'll go with you and take you there, because it's kind of hard to find. So they moved some stuff around, and off we drove. And I just took a shining to the guy. He was a nice guy. And, you know, you take pity on somebody that's at the end of the road. And we went down, and we have little Zodiac boats. I took him out to the airplane, and I tied up, and we went inside the airplane, and he walked to one of the windows on the upper deck, and he had tears in his eyes, and he says, that's the window. He said, for 17 hours, I looked out that window from my stretcher. He was medevaced out of Korea.
Oh, wow.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's long gone now. And then down at Elsinore, the other shift had this sweet little 90-year-old flight nurse come and wanted a tour of the airplane. And she said, the boys used to we used to have a seat right here between the two pilots, like just behind the console or a pedestal. And she says, yeah, they were really nice. They would let me flick this switch. And there was this hole in the pedestal, and we never used it. There was nothing in it. And what it was the Jado bottle firing switch.
All right.
And she says, yeah, the boys used to let me fire the Jado bottles when we were taking off out of Alameda for Honolulu. So that was pretty neat. That put a smile on our faces.
That's some good crew resource management there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I can only imagine the people that you meet, Pete. That must be incredible. You know, the aircraft attracts so many different people, doesn't it? I mean,
crazy amounts. I got to fly with Harrison Ford.
Oh, wow.
At Oshkosh, he came. He's a pretty cool guy, pretty low-key. I gave up my seat, so he had a seat to sit in and get some stick time.
No, that's pretty epic.
Yeah. Clay Lacy, you know, he flew Mars around.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, lots of that kind of stuff. It's such a blur. There's so many people.
And I know that recently there was the availability for the general public to go and get a type rating on this aircraft.
We had 6 or 8 guys come.
Yep.
That was kind of neat. We'd take 2 at a time, and then, you know, you get the benefit of watching somebody else fly the airplane and still get a couple more hours. I don't think they specifically got type ratings. They just got to be Walter Mitty and be a Mars pilot for a day.
Yeah, right. What was the cost on that?
I have no idea.
I heard a rumor it was something like $25,000 US or something like that for a couple
That sounds pretty close. I don't know. That's not my department.
That's just going to cover the fuel bill, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it gets us current.
Yeah, true. Yeah, well, like two birds with one stone.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And did you meet some interesting characters doing that?
Yeah, one guy was a hydroplane racer from Seattle, and the next year he was killed in an accident. And a racing car driver. And he was killed the next year, which was sad. Sultan of Saudi Arabia, a Sultan.
Wow.
He flew a BBJ, and he wanted to fly it. And, you know, his security guys were saying, no, you can't do it. He says, yeah, I can, and I am. You know. And I couldn't believe the security. We didn't know where we were going. We were just, you know, took them off out on Lake Winnebago, and we took off and did a couple pickups and drops. And wherever we landed, his security was right alongside of in jet boats.
Yeah, wow.
They could follow us, and they would send them pictures, like live stream to them. Oh, look at that. My guys are right here with us. And they were in a boat.
Yeah, right.
But the Mars isn't a fast airplane. No. You know, when we airspeed limited with a load, 120 knots, and 150 knots is all we cruise it at. We don't want to wear it out any faster than we have. Like in the time... In the 50, 60 years it was up here in Canada, they only flew an average of 4,000 hours per aircraft.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, they came up with 18,000 hours, and now they're at 22,000. But they don't really age, you know, with the maintenance that they did. They weren't a pressurized aircraft, so it didn't take too long.
No.
You know, it didn't take too much out of the aircraft. And they had a pretty good maintenance program. Corrosion's always an ongoing issue, but try to do stuff as we need it.
Yeah. Now, Steve Stackhouse was on the show a couple of episodes ago, and he sent me an email once we spoke about getting you on. And he said that I've got to ask you a question about this gantry winch or crane that's in the back of the aircraft. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a track that is up in the wing, and it's about, you know, I don't know what all the guts of it are like, but there's a track that runs basically from roughly where number three engine is, or number two engine, you know, either side, because there's great big doors. And I don't know what the loading weight was, but I've seen pictures of them picking up a Willys Jeep.
Yeah, right.
and sliding it in on the track, a little motor to the center section. They turn the Jeep around, and they can position it wherever they want in the hull. It kind of negated that option when they put the bomb tanks in it, but the guts are still in it.
There's so much unique stuff about this airplane. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Pete, we are kind of getting near the end there, mate. I don't want to hold you up too long. Near the end of the interview, I like to go through a splash and dash questionnaire, which is like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash. We'll just touch on a few questions.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that the Mars is your favorite seaplane that you've ever flown. I can't imagine that it wouldn't be.
Well, you know what? I have a million people ask me that.
Oh, yeah?
And my answer is my favorite airplane is the one I'm in.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Fair enough. That's a good answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I love them all. They all talk to you different. They all have different purposes. But as long as you're up in the air flying, that's That's good enough for me.
Yeah, no,
I just finished 5 years on the Norseman, and it almost killed me.
Oh,
but
wow!
I still love them. I had a bad accident last June.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm alive, and I'm a little worse for wear and tear. But
can you share a little bit about what happened there, or?
Yeah, I screwed up a landing and almost drowned myself, and I broke my back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Just hooked afloat and ended up on the bottom, and it was a real fight for survival, believe me.
Yeah.
Both front doors were jammed. I had a full load of cargo. Had to hold my breath for 2 minutes. And
jeez.
Then I held on to the wreckage in a lake that the ice had just gone out 2 weeks before, and it was an hour and 10 minutes before they found me.
Oh, that's
so
crazy.
Other than that, it was kind of a crappy day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's all whilst having a broken back.
Yeah, yeah. And the worst part was watching a flat of beer drift away. I thought to myself, I could use one of those right now.
Yeah, good to hear you didn't lose your sense of humor during the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah,
I kind of wrapped it up, hardcore bush flying for me. Now I'm just trying to find my favorite airplane still.
That's incredible. So what was the Norseman like to fly before that?
It's old school aviation. And being a career bush pilot, I loved every minute of it. It's a purpose-built airplane. To me, it's the first real bush plane. You know, it was purpose-built for hauling cargo, and it does a good job of it, and it still does a good job up in the North Country to this day. You know, I don't know how many are operating still, but they're pretty cool.
Yeah, because I've read a little bit about it once when I started to fly the Beaver, and it's basically a Beaver, but 10 years earlier, isn't it?
Yeah.
Similar engine.
No, it's a 1340 direct drive, 550 horse.
Oh, bigger,
it's
even more.
It's more the size of a single otter.
Yeah, right. Okay.
It's probably got the same reliability as a piston otter.
Yeah.
They're all trying to kill you.
But... and then the whole, is it the whole frame is fabric as well on this aircraft?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy to think, for such a, well, I mean, this is probably more common back in the day, but, you know, for me now and probably a lot of young people coming through the industry, to think of a 550 horsepower, I think you said, radial engine strapped to
pipe
a fabric
and rag.
Fuselage.
Pipe and rag, yeah. Yeah,
and that's your specialty, isn't it?
For work, yeah. I have a pretty booming business going, rebuilding fabric airplanes.
Yeah, right.
I got a 1935 Waco that I'm building up as a float plane for a customer.
And where do you do all that work?
Right at home here. So I have a good COVID timeout gig going on right now.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah.
Still smashing the workout.
Oh, yeah, big time, yeah.
Back to the splash and dash questionnaire. I got a little bit sidetracked there when you kind of tell me you nearly killed yourself last year. A lake, a river, open ocean, or a coral cay, what's been the best place that you ever landed a seaplane?
Oh, anywhere there's deep water.
I'm getting a bit of a trend here.
Yeah.
Anything that flies, anything that's got deep water.
Yeah.
This is going to be a complicated question then. Is there any seaplanes that you didn't get to fly that you would like to?
Yeah. The way I tackle my airplane, I don't want to go out. I've flown the Goose. I've flown a little bit in the Mallard, a little bit in the Widgeon. But like the Norseman, I didn't want to just get a checkout. In the airplane, I wanted to go work it, and that's why I stuck with the Norseman for 5 years. I would like to do the Grumman's as a proper pilot in command, not somebody saying, here, go fly it for 20 minutes and tell me it's the best airplane in the world. Well, yeah. No, I would rather go to work in it for a while. And that's, I've been very fortunate, you know, in that respect. Like, I've done a bunch of long distance flying in the Goose and, you know, a few circuits on wheels and a few circuits on, you know, in the water. And the same, the Mallard, we took it down to Reno a couple of years ago. That was pretty neat. But, you know, to get in, learn the airplane, learn the systems and learn how they work. Where I grew up, the only airplane until I was 17 years old that I'd ever really been in any amount was the Grumman Mallard. So, you know, I know them, but I haven't flown them in such a way that I've worked them, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And the same, I haven't flown the Albatross.
Yeah. No, there's some guys in Texas that have got the Albatross there that I interviewed on the show. But like you said, he could get you in there, but it's more about kind of getting to know them deep down, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, yeah, there's more to, you know, sure. Yeah, I've done that. Like, no, you got to go out and fly it and work it and load it and unload it and fuel it and oil it. You know, there's more to it than doing a circuit.
Yeah.
And being a mechanic as well, I like tinkering with them too.
Yeah.
So,
It's cool. There's a lot of people I've interviewed who have kind of gone down the maintenance path as well. Especially, it's probably a bit more of an old school thing, I'd say, that a lot of guys get their maintenance ticket and then kind of do some flying as well. But it sounds like a really handy thing to have.
Oh, it is. I've got two airplanes of my own, and both of them have been ground up restorations. They're a lot of fun, a lot of entertainment.
I bet. From hearing your story, I haven't picked up on any actual turbine seaplane flying. Have you done any of that? Actually, you did say twin otter, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, at Colson's, I had a Soloy 206 that I flew for about 400 hours. And then the twin otter, I did a season at Harbor Air up and down the coast. Colson's, I flew their amphib twin otter a bit. So, I got 800 hours in turbines.
It's so old school just to have so much piston time these days, you know, the way things are going with turbine aircraft. It's almost, you know, a bit random that you have so little turbine time for your experience.
Yeah. Well, last year I delivered a Soloy 185 on wheels out to Manitoba from Campbell River. That was pretty cool airplane.
What's a Soloy?
That's a Allison C-20.
Okay.
419 horsepower.
Yep. Funny. Geez, that'd be a rocket.
Yeah, you know what? It had those 31-inch bush wheels on it, and it kind of set up a vibration that it took me a little while to figure out what it was. Flying along, you know, pushing lots of air around those tires, I looked down, and they're pulsating.
Oh.
The airplane's going too fast for those big old balloon tires. So, not that much turbine. And a Turbo Beaver I flew a little bit there, got checked out and did a trip or two.
Yeah. Let's say you're on a glassy day on a lake. What aircraft would you want to be in?
Not a Norseman.
Fair enough.
You know what? I taught a lot of float flying, and I thought I was pretty good at it. And for the most part, I was until my last landing in a Norseman.
Yeah.
But I always just set VSI up for a nose up and descended about 100 feet a minute. And as long as you're in the nose up and power on, she'll just slide down. You look out the window, you see the wing coming up in the shadow, and next thing you know, you're on the water. No, I don't have a particular favorite on a glassy water airplane. If you know what you're doing, it doesn't matter what you're in.
Yeah.
It's attitude and airspeed.
Yeah.
I had a bad attitude on that last landing.
So that was a glassy water accident, was it?
Yeah. 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 I was low in a turn and basically I think I stalled it in the turn. I was just maneuvering and I didn't see it coming. I didn't think I was slow. And in a millisecond, I was fighting for my life.
It's a good reality check for all of us, you know, to think that someone like yourself with so much experience can be bitten like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I looked in my logbook and I think it was 17,800 hours on floats to do this landing. I guess I'm a slow learner.
Yeah, geez. I hope I learn quickly then, because I've still got a long way to go compared to that.
Yeah. Well, just don't do it.
No.
The one thing I can say is for anybody in the float plane world is take that underwater egress course.
Yeah, I've done that. Yep.
I did it. I've done it twice.
Yep.
And I was still current on my 3-year. We have it every 3 years. It's good. It works. And I phoned Brian Webster, the guy that put on my course, and told him I should become a motivational speaker for him. Because when we did the course, there's some things that are not real. Throw ice cubes in the pool.
Yeah.
Get it cold. Don't do it in a nice heated pool.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe on the Great Barrier Reef you're okay, but you're certainly not okay in northern Manitoba in the middle of nowhere.
No.
I was 650 miles north of Winnipeg.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think that's a good course for any aspiring and current seaplane pilot to take.
Yeah, like I said, I did it in a pool in the Whitsundays, you know, North Queensland, tropical location, and I still learnt a lot, you know.
Yeah. Well, I got tangled up in the cargo nets and the ropes in the back. I had a horrendous load on, and it was a real fight to get out.
It's incredible what the body will do to kind of fight for your life, isn't it?
Oh, well, the number one thing is don't panic.
Yeah.
And I didn't, so, yeah.
Yeah, incredible. Pete, last question. Looking back at your career, what's been probably the biggest highlight? A bit of a hard one. Wrap it all up.
Every day's a highlight.
Yeah.
You know, getting to fly the Mars is, you know, it's got to be up there. But being a career bush pilot, I wasn't an airline guy. I just liked the outdoors and the people. I met all kinds of cool people, you know, flown the prime minister. You know, you end up with such a wide variety, movie stars. And, you know, I'm not tooting my horn. That's just the way it is that, you know, people from all walks of life are just super. And the people you meet, like peers, like us, just BSing about aviation. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wish I had another 40 years to give to it.
Yeah.
But like now I've been flying full time. I started in 1973 and I'm still active.
Yeah.
Now, not so much commercially. I fly a couple corporate airplanes, Amphib Beavers and stuff like that. And I like delivering airplanes.
Yep.
I do a lot of Amphib Beavers into the States and Alaska. And it's been fun teaching my son how to become a bush pilot. And he's off on trying to get through the COVID thing, but he's instructing now and I've given him a couple hundred hours tail dragon flying and float flying. For a student pilot, end up with a bunch of Beaver Time wheels and floats and amphibs and Alaskan 185. He's doing good.
Yeah, nice.
Yep.
Awesome, Pete. It's been incredible talking to you and hearing your story, and really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to come onto the step, mate, and talk with me.
Well, my pleasure.
All the best.
All the best. Thanks for the call.
And that's the show for today, folks. What a legend you are, Mr. Peter Killen. Such a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope once this COVID business is over, I can come and meet you and your flying ship in the not-too-distant future. I hope you all love this chat with Peter, folks. If so, please get it out there by telling a friend, sharing it on social media, and reviewing with Apple Podcasts. If you want to support the show further, come and join me and the others on Patreon, where you can grow this show for less than a cup of coffee a month. How good is that? Next episode, I will talk to one of the people behind a post-World War I seaplane replica build that is happening as we speak in the UK today. But until next time, everyone, thanks very much for coming on The Step.